This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we built the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week we're doing our very best to gross you out by finding out everything you could possibly want to know about the medicinal leech.
Everything you never wanted to know about the medicinal leech, basically. I'm standing here in the car park and basically, you know, way up high, there is contrails of a plane heading for America, probably. But you can see it through gaps in the cloud. It's actually not bad. It's probably 3 or 4 degrees. And I'm standing here in the car park. I'm Mark Stephen. Across the other side of the fire, Rachel Stewart.
Yeah, it's quite not a bad morning, actually. About 2 degrees, I think it is. So still a wee bit chilly. I actually saw a barn owl on my way in this morning. And the birds are beginning to chirp a wee bit. So it feels quite spring-like.
Hey, if you may recall last week's mystery sound with Sparrowhawk, and I mentioned my encounter with one, Jo got in touch to share her sparrow talk also. She says, I was walking the old Deeside railway line on the outskirts of Aberdeen when a sparrowhawk swooped low in front of me and dived under a conifer whose branches covered the ground. Moments later, it emerged clutching a blackbird.
It did. It stood in the path no more than 6 feet from me. We both froze and stared at each other. Had it been a rare bird, I would have intervened, but I thought, no, the sparrowhawk has to live as well, so left well alone. After what seemed an age, it decided to let its prey go, and the blackbird flew off unharmed. Love your programme. Kind regards, Joe, now living in Linlithgow. Nice story.
You may say the blackbird was unharmed.
Probably a little bit traumatised.
Was it still in therapy, I would have thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the moment you've been waiting for the mystery sound, shall we have our first blast of the morning?
Oh, go for it, go for it. I think there's going to be lots of people listening to that who can't actually hear it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just on the border for me.
Yeah. And you're comparatively young.
Well, comparatively. If you think you know what it is, get in touch with us. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or you can give us a ring 08085 92 95 00, and you can get in touch too just to tell us what your plans are for the day and what you've been up to this week.
If you're one of those people who listened to that and thought, they're not playing anything at all. Honestly, we were. There is something there, but it's very, very low.
We'll give you a bit of warning before we play it again so you can turn the radio up.
Turn the volume right the way up or put headphones on might be a good idea.
Yeah. Good advice.
Let us turn our attention now to what is believed to be the UK's largest urban farm. Lauriston Agroecology Farm is a 100-acre site near Edinburgh Airport. Actually, it's not that near Edinburgh Airport, but it's on the flight path. It's run as a community cooperative, and there's all sorts of things going on there, as I learned from Lisa Houston, who was involved from the start. Now, before we get to talking about the nitty-gritty of it, I was fascinated. This is a prime site, right? It is very close to what is one of the poshest areas of Edinburgh. How on earth did it avoid being turned into housing development?
One of the interesting facts about this piece of land is the reason this hasn't been developed is the castle. So we're right in front of Lauriston Castle. We found out when we came on site is that the land was owned by families, and then in the 60s, I think, they handed it over to the council, the family that had it previously. And basically, there's some kind of 16th century title deed that declares that the Lord's view from the castle across to Fife shall not be blocked.
So they couldn't build on it.
Yeah, and they still take it completely seriously because right from the start of all our conversations with the council, they go, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Now, you do know about the Lord's view. There's no Lord. In the summertime, the castle's trees are already massive, but that has kept it safe all this time.
I did wonder because, you know, it did seem to be an incredible act of generosity, particularly, you know, in a nice area, the outskirts of Edinburgh, 100 acres, just handing it over to the community. I thought there must be a story behind that. That's brilliant.
It is good.
You obviously have room for expansion.
Yes. about a third of the land is earmarked just for habitat creation.
Okay.
But then our food production for sale, which is where the market garden is, currently we've got 20 acres in deer fence over there. We've not yet got that all under production, but the idea is that within 5 years we will. So that's going to include vegetable production, fruit production, grain growing, some field-scale crops, and we also have a number of other enterprises down there, rice, mushrooms.
Grain growing?
Yeah.
On what scale? Are you specialising in ancient varieties or something?
Yeah.
Ah, right. Okay, got
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
it's
the plan,
an experimental thing.
I also work with Grant and Community Gardeners. And at Grant and Community Gardeners, they've been growing wheat on street corners for the last
Seriously?
8 or 9 years where
Why?
The council housing is. Why not? It's interesting.
Oh, it is interesting.
It's
I just
part
want,
of
I
Scotland wonder, the Bread Soil to Slice project.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Yeah. I wonder if they actually harvest it at any stage and do
yes,
something
yes.
to do.
Yes, so what happened was local neighbours were harvesting it and then they learned from Scotland the Bread how to make sourdough bread and now we have a bakery. So in Granton we have a community bakery uh-huh. that sells bread on a pay-what-you-can basis. In amongst council housing, you don't often see a sourdough offering there. It's done out the back window of a community centre. So then what we decided was to start taking the wheat that's grown on the street corners, saving the seed from it, and growing a bigger patch here. So we grew 500 square metres last year of that wheat, and it did pretty well. We also planted up a history of wheat plot. So we started from Emer and Einkorn all the way up to new varieties that are coming out of the James Hutton Institute. And then that 500 square metres of wheat, we have then expanded again by just saving the seed and growing on more.
So this is not just a resource for local people. You can also use this for university students, for James Hutton and all that kind of thing. They can come here and play and do stuff at the same time.
I think because we're an urban farm, it's a bit different in that what we want, as well as being able to grow lots of good food and feed lots of people and everything, is we want people to understand the food system better. So we want people to come on and learn about regenerative farming, learn about the soil, learn about worms, learn about the birds, learn about the insects and all that. But also there is, it's quite handy for quite a lot of work working with different academic people. So we're also working with Edinburgh University to see if it's possible to create a zero carbon loaf of bread.
How would you go about doing that?
Aye, so biochar, apparently, because it's a bit of a carbon sink.
Okay, biochar being?
It's a way of creating, I think, like activated charcoal. But so you're making charcoal at very, very high temperatures. You're creating something that's very, very porous, that absorbs lots of things and kind of holds nutrients in the soil. Mm-hmm. And so you add that to the soil and it helps to sort of retain nutrients in the soil and carbon. I don't think we'll create a zero-carbon loaf this year. It's our first year of farming and we're shifting.
How would you bake a zero-carbon loaf?
Okay.
Because basically you've got energy coming in on that.
Well, first of all, you're looking at the whole life cycle assessment, right? So you're looking at from where your seed comes from, how you're growing it, what's happening in the field, how you're transporting it, where it's being threshed, dried and milled, and how it's being baked. So we're saving already because, I mean, most bakeries get their flour from Canada and previously Ukraine.
Yeah.
So if we've got flour growing here and we're potentially cycling it down the bike path to Grantham Bakery, that's already taken out a certain amount of carbon. Then if you manage to develop your bakery, so we're the bakery that is in Grantham is looking to get a new site where you're making energy efficiencies between the heat that comes off the ovens being transferred into another kind of energy or where, again, not an area of expertise of mine, but that's what I understand. And if you use biochar, you may be able to offset some of the energy costs there. So I haven't a scientist, but we do have a team of them working with us. And we won't be doing this instantly, but it's also an idea to try and put that out there as like looking at the life cycle assessment, looking at where the gains and losses can or can't be made, and trying to say to people, look, here's a model that we can be working with and changing the food carbon footprint.
There is a certain irony here, because you can hear that in the background.
Oh, aye.
You are on the flight path for Edinburgh Airport.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about tiny, tiny, minuscule amounts of carbon, etc., in a loaf.
I know.
And that is going past every 3 minutes.
I know.
Lisa Houston there at Lauriston Farm near Edinburgh. You can hear the full conversation with Lisa on the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available on BBC Sounds. I mean, they've got heaps of stuff. going yeah. on there.
Loads know? And loads. I like their seed kist.
Aye.
That's a very nice idea. And also just how they do their allotments. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just anyone can turn up and get an allotment. They really thought about how they could maximise the community use of these allotments yeah. and how to kind of force people to mingle
to
when they're there.
To talk to one another
yeah.
and things.
Yeah. Clever idea.
So, no, there was a lot there. Sorry, I was slightly distracted at the start of the programme. Did you mention seeing a barn owl?
I did. I thought, oh, well, this conversation has not gone well. He's just cut me dead.
Yeah, so, poo to your barn owl, I care not. You know, well, sorry, but I didn't.
I took a slightly different route to work today and just take the corner in my eye. I thought, what is that white thing there? Ah, it's a barn owl. Very nice to see.
Yeah, this is almost like being married. It's just, sometime later, the word floats to the surface and you think, fire? What a fire? There was something I saw this morning on the way in the car, and for the life of me, I couldn't tell you what it was. It came out, and I mean, to the extent I wasn't sure whether it was a bird or an animal, something came out of the undergrowth, headed towards the road, and then doubled back and kind of went through the fence line.
Okay.
So I almost don't know.
Okay.
Brownish.
Brownish.
Yeah, brownish, okay. But I don't know.
Interesting. We're actually sticking with beasties today. It's a bit of a beasties theme to the programme today. You'll remember a few months ago we spoke about the new discovery of medicinal leeches in Dumfries and Galloway. Now, it's good news for them because the reality is they're still... good news for them that they were found in Dumfries and Galloway, but the reality is they're not in a great state because they're only found, you'll remember this, in three locations.
In Scotland.
So to boost their numbers, there's a conservation breeding programme underway by the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland. Now, I met up with keeper Adam Button and Dr. Helen Taylor at a purpose-built facility at the Highland Wildlife Park where the leeches are living in, I suppose, what looks like just big fish tanks.
They do look like fish tanks, but they're actually specially made. Adam, our experienced keeper, designed these tanks especially for the leeches and then had a buddy of his make them up. They're made so that we can fill them to a certain level. So you'll see they're not full of water. They're about half full of water. They've got special mesh vents on so that we've got lots of air coming through, but so that the leeches can't get out. And we've got sliding doors at the top that we can move across so that we can access the tanks in order to put in clean water, put in different bits and pieces of enrichment. You can see that they're not just plain tanks of water. They've got slate, they've got little plant pots, they've got floating pieces of wood, they've got soap dishes on the side with moss in. And this is all to give the leeches a variety of habitats. You know, it's really hard for invertebrates to tell us what they want and where they want to be. So the idea is that we just give them lots of choice and then they can choose where they want to be, and that tells us what they prefer.
Yeah, roughly replicating what they might see in the wild.
Yes, as much as possible, but still making it so that we can see the animals on a day-to-day basis and make sure that they're okay and keep them healthy.
Now, I don't see them. Where are they? Are they hiding?
So their favourite spots to sit at the moment is under all of the slates. So we've got a number of slates in the enclosures that we pile up in different ways. And that's to make lots of nice little hidey holes for the leeches to actually go into. So they tend to stick themselves in the smallest gap they physically can. So they're nice and sheltered away from us. So it's quite a bit of a challenge trying to find them each day. But I have seen every single one of them this morning. But now it's the fun challenge trying to actually spot where they are. So we've got 8 small leeches in this tank here. And there's one actually just round the corner here. So if you look in through this side of the tank, you can see one. He's just tucked behind the stone in there.
Yeah, he looks quite small, doesn't he? I was expecting them to be quite big.
Yeah, so the ones in that tank are the smaller individuals. We think they're somewhere around 18 months to 2 years old. So they're still quite young and quite small compared to the others. But in the other 4 tanks we've got in here, we've got the bigger ones, which are over 2 years old.
If you look through the side here,
yes.
You can see he's just poking his head out between the slate, having a look. So, I mean, this time of year, the water's quite cold. They're not particularly active. They're all pretty well fed at the moment. So that's the other thing. Once they get hungry, they'll start telling us they're hungry, because when we come in the room, they sense the vibrations. They'll start swimming around, putting their heads out of the water, looking at what's going on, seeking out food. At the moment, they're not doing that. They're pretty much dormant over winter. They're conserving energy, hunkering down, sometimes all huddling together like penguins, just waiting for the water to get warmer, for the temperature to rise so that they can become active again and get ready for their breeding season.
They're quite dark and stripy.
Mm. So it's really interesting, actually. They have this really cool pattern on the top of them that's quite distinctive, and that's how we can tell the different species of leech apart, by their patterning. So we do have 17 species of leech in Britain. This is just one of them. If you see their undersides, they're really speckled, and we're hoping that the speckles are going to be unique between individuals, like a fingerprint. So it might help us tell individuals apart, because they very much all just look like leeches to us. And the interesting thing, you mentioned that they're quite dark, and they're very different to the same species in England. When you find medicinal leech in England, the patterns are much, much more striking, because there's much more contrast between the colours on the animal, and so it's much more obvious, these patterns. And the ones in Scotland are a lot darker, and we don't know why. It could be to do with the fact that the water they're living in Scotland is quite peaty, and so in terms of camouflage and not being seen by predators, it's better to be a bit darker rather than standing out. But that's just a theory. We really don't know what's going on there.
I'm desperate to find out what you feed them.
So these guys actually do feed on blood, so that is what we feed them. We collect blood on site here. We then freeze it so that we can use it at a later date. We put it into small portions so that we can then bring it out as and when we need it, because they don't feed very often. The adults in here haven't fed since late last year, about 3 months ago. And the babies, we popped them some food in January, so they can go over 3 months plus during the winter without needing a feed. So we have the blood frozen in our freezer to be able to then bring out when we need it for the leeches. We then defrost it when they actually start acting like they're hungry. We have to then put it through a blender.
Yuck.
It's definitely an interesting process, but they won't feed on it if it's coagulated, like they know it's not from something live. So if you blend it, it mixes all the cells back up in the blood, and that makes it really palatable for the leeches. So we do that, and then we put it into a sausage skin, tie it off at both ends to make a little blood sausage. We put that into a little warm water bath to bring it up to around body temperature, at which point we then pop it in with the leeches and they latch on and then they can have their feed.
So a sausage supper sounds delightful. Where do you actually get the blood from? You see you gather it up here.
So just to be clear, it's not from people. So we're not feeding them. Adam doesn't personally feed the leeches on himself. We use deer blood. So basically in the wild, what adult medicinal leeches would be feeding on would be deer or cattle, if there's livestock present. The babies will feed on fish and amphibians. So we're just trying to mimic that as closely as we can. So we give them deer blood because we know that that's something that they're into, and they feed really well on that. And Adam basically has his own wee cooking show going on in the food prep room with the blender and the little sous vide type contraption that he uses to bring it up to body temperature, and it's all about making it into something that is palatable for them. So as Adam said, if it's not warm, if it's not mixed properly, they're not going to eat it. They're quite picky. Although they do feed exclusively on blood, it's got to be from the right kind of animal, and it's got to be at body temperature. So we've got to trick them into thinking they're eating from a live animal rather than something that we've stashed in the freezer for however many months.
How do you handle them, given that they do want to get your blood if they get half a chance?
So with these guys, we have to be quite careful, obviously, because they might try and feed on us. When it comes to moving them around, we mostly try and use nets, but then we also use gloves. So the gloves give us a biosecurity protection, but also gives us an extra sort of 15, 20 seconds if a leech does sucker onto us, just to take our glove off, and then they're not going to be able to actually latch onto us and properly.
An extra 15 seconds? You wouldn't need to be faffing around, would you?
No, it's literally if they sucker onto you, glove comes off, we leave them to it, they quickly realise it's cold, and they go, now we're not bothered by this, and let go.
Adam Button and Dr. Helen Taylor, and we'll hear more about how they plan to breed the leeches a little later in the programme.
Should we have put out an advisory at the beginning of this?
I think we probably
just
should
saying,
have done.
If you're of a nervous disposition, you may not want to listen to this.
No, indeed. I wonder if you were planning to have a smoothie this morning and you were taking the blender out of the cupboard.
Yeah,
I wonder if you just put it straight back in.
Nah, fine. Yeah, no, all of the above. Years ago, I did a programme in America about a type of poisonous marine snail called a cone shell. We went to this laboratory, and again, little fish tank and what have you. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, sand in the bottom, a rock. And the cone shells are really pretty, you know, people yeah. collect the shells, but they are also unbelievably venomous. And the guy says, and he puts this like welder's mitt on, mm-hmm. and he's got these barbecue tongs, and he says, I'll just get one out for you and what have you. And I laughed and I said, are you worried about one of these things sneaking up on you? And he went, yes. He says, if we held hands, mm-hmm. okay, one of these little cone shells and what have you, says, if we held hands, says, and the toxin could pass from hand to hand, one sting from one of these things, one sting would kill 12 of us.
Wow.
12 of us. And the thing is, they have a huge palette of toxins. So they vary. And what they did was they actually put little, you know, I used to keep tropical fish, and there's a type of fish called a guppy. Mm-hmm. And he took this fish and he sort of dangled it in front of the, you know, on tweezers.
Yeah.
And dangled it in front of the cone shell and what have you. And, you know, you could see the proboscis coming out. And it's like a little harpoon and it goes ding, you know, with a fish. And it died instantly. Mm-hmm. I mean, just absolutely instantly. And I said, why are they so toxic as that? And he said, because in the reef, if you have something thrashing about, that attracts other predators and mm-hmm. things like that, and your chances are you'll lose your meal.
Yeah.
Whereas if it dies instantaneously like that, it's quiet, it's utterly inobtrusive, and the snail will have access to its meal exclusively.
Very clever, yeah.
Just really fascinating.
I'd be wanting the lid back on that tank pretty quickly, though.
Well, they were studying it because an awful lot of, you know, the pharmaceutical industry work off materials that are naturally sourced and things, and there is a possibility that some of these toxins could be used as painkillers.
Mm.
You know, in obviously much smaller doses.
Yeah.
But
fascinating.
Fascinating stuff. Coming up, Oban's answer to the Colosseum.
And of course, we've got a mystery sign for you today. Let's have a listen. Turn your radio up.
See, I know for a fact my dad's going to be listening to that going, there's nothing there.
It's
nothing
subtle.
There. What are you on about?
apparently, we've got a correct guess already.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, correct one already. A few incorrect answers. We'll get to them soon. Mm-hmm. But you've got plenty of time to have a guess. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the email address. Or text us 80295. Or Skye is manning the phone. She's on 0808 59295.
A bar now, you say.
You're back to this again. It really is like being married.
Minke whales are found across the world, and they can be spotted around Scotland's waters, mainly between July and September. There's a reasonably widespread population, right? They're not entirely rare, but the fact of the matter is we don't know an awful lot about them. Tim Aubrey is a researcher at the Scottish Association for Marine Science, and he's been carrying out studies on these whales.
A minke whale is possibly a bit different to what people have their stereotyped idea of what a whale looks like. They're a bit more narrow, they've got a pointier nose, normally about 10-ish metres long, so a bit shorter than some of the other whales, and about 10-ish tonnes as well. And the way to tell a minke whale apart from other whales is they've got these white bands on the pectoral fins, so on the front fins, which are the equivalent to our arms.
And how much do we know about their life cycle? I mean, do they stay in one area? Are they migratory?
That's a great question. And the very short answer is we know very little about their life cycle. So minke whales, particularly on the Western Atlantic, so down Canada, America, and kind of down to the Caribbean, we know that they migrate down southwards. And we've got quite a good idea from acoustic recorders down that side of the coast where they're going and what kind of time of year they're there. We don't actually know, which is quite embarrassing as minke whale researchers, we don't actually know where they go once they leave kind of Scottish, English and Irish waters. It's possible that they're also heading across the Caribbean, but also possible that they're kind of heading off to northwest Africa.
Kind of a big area.
Yeah, just a small southern Atlantic Ocean difference. You think about it, we know the migration patterns of kind of tiny little brown birds that come from Africa to Europe and back each year. It's really quite phenomenal that we don't know where the minke whales are going once they leave Scottish waters.
So nobody's actually tagged one of these things, you know, put a satellite tracker on it, etc., and followed it?
So the only whales that I'm aware of that have been tagged were kind of done in the central Atlantic, and they headed straight down the mid-Atlantic ridge, and then the tags came off. There's kind of great difficulties with tagging minke whales. They seem to slip off with the kind of classic suction tags that we put onto other baleen whales. They're also quite, particularly on the West Coast, they're quite skittish animals. They don't seem to enjoy the presence of boats, so it makes it a bit harder to get
one on in the first place must be quite problematic.
Exactly.
If they don't like boats and they are skittish, how do you track them around UK waters?
there's two ways that I approach this. The first, I use visual data. So this is data collected from the Hebridean Whale and Dolphin Trust, and they've been kind of scouring Scottish waters on the west coast for the last 20 years or so. So I use their data and relate that to different kind of environmental data. So what depths are we seeing minke whales at, and what depths are we not seeing them at, and things like that. And through that, we can kind of build patterns of what areas at what time of year might be suitable. The second thing is we've got two large arrays that we work with off the west coast. So these are hydrophones, which are underwater microphones, both inside the Hebrides through a project which is called the Compass Project that ran from 2017 to 2022. But also we've had hydrophones to the west of that as well, so outside of the Outer Hebrides going out towards the shelf. So we can begin to look at the minke whale calls during that kind of period and see what kind of times that they're in Scottish waters.
Most species, when they migrate, are either following foodstuffs or they're going to a breeding ground. Do they have a breeding season, minke whales, or do they breed throughout the year? Is it possible they're going to a breeding ground?
So, again, this is kind of one of the great unknowns. And through some of the, you know, the anecdotal visual sightings we've had and some of the acoustic recordings, we know that we've got at least a couple of minke whales that are sticking here year-round. The big whales, like minke whales, blue whales, fin whales, they are travelling down to tropical waters to breed. So I think the most likely scenario is that's probably what minke whales are doing as well.
You see reports all the time about strandings of various whales. Are they prone to strandings?
Minke whales do strand relatively often. And what we're finding with minke whale strandings is that a lot of them seem to have kind of entanglement scars. So that either they've got entanglement scars, which is to do with being caught in fishing gear, or they've actually got the fishing gear wrapped around them. And generally this is from creel fisheries, which is otherwise a really sustainable fishery. So one of the projects we're working on here at SAMS is with the Scottish Entanglement Alliance. So this is a group of different NGOs, academic, government and industry, most importantly, that we work together to try and really assess how big of a problem this is. So in Scotland alone, we think about 30 minke whales die each year from entanglement, and about 6 humpback whales, which is really quite a huge number. So we're working with a number of different options, including the use of a sinking ground line. So this just would make sure that there's less rope in the water column for the animal to actually get caught up in.
Is entanglement the only threat from humans that minkes face?
One of the big problems we're going to see over the upcoming years, as kind of competition for space in the marine environment becomes bigger and bigger, is the anthropogenic noise. So noise produced by boats, by piling for wind turbines and seismic surveys and things like that. They all overlap with the same frequencies that minke whales use to communicate with. So if you imagine that you and I were in a kind of crowded bar, it becomes harder and harder to hear what each other's saying as more and more people are in there talking. So that's a similar kind of concept with marine vessels, because they're at very similar frequencies to what minke whales use to communicate with. Then I think we're going to have more and more problems with them struggling to communicate.
And a very generic question, are they doing well in Scottish waters at the moment?
Yeah, so that's a really kind of difficult question to answer, and it's something that we're trying to answer at the moment. There's just so much variation in the data, and particularly the way that we collect the data. Anecdotally, the Hebridean Whale and Dolphin Trust are certainly seeing more minke whales in the last couple of years than they have previously. And anecdotally, they seem to be doing really well, but we're always a bit cautious as scientists before we say that for sure.
Tim Aubrey of the Scottish Association for Marine Science near Oban, better known as SAMS. It's a lot easier to say.
I think because we see amazing footage of creatures like this on the telly all the time, you just assume that we know lots and lots about them and they must be easy to track, but obviously not.
It is astonishing how many species we actually know remarkably little about.
Yeah.
You know, and I was saying to him, surely you could stick a tracker or something. He says, no, this is the for whatever reason, they don't stick to minkes.
Slip off.
Don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
you know. And that led me to think about, you know, sort of like ear tags and cattle or sheep or things. Like, surely you could do something through, you know, a fin or something like that. But he said they're very elusive. They're quite shy. So, you know, they're not going to hang around to let you do it.
No, no, exactly.
Strangely.
Exactly, yeah. I have seen them, I think, off the Murray coast, actually. And I think you might be able to see them quite soon. Is it May-ish? You might be able to catch sight of them. Getting there.
Moving about. There's lots of stuff in the water, but again, it always strikes me. There's a transition between what we can see on the surface and what's happening below. And I think if we had a clearer idea of what was happening below, and a lot of divers say this, so people would be a lot more worried about things like some marine pollution and litter and pollution. You know, just the stuff that's going on is not good.
Yeah, and of course, that's a big threat to them, as he was saying.
Yeah, indeed. Coming up, we've got vaulting on and off horses and the discovery, I mean, the unbelievable discovery and restoration of an Aberdeen tram.
Yeah, this got you very, very excited,
Rachel,
to hear it. We've also got a mystery sound for you. Let's have a listen.
Now, I am convinced that there's going to be quite a few listeners out there going, I can't hear anything.
Yeah.
At all.
Silence.
Silence. But there is something there, I swear it. These are wrong answers. Karen in Shetland says, sounded a bit like an ultrasound heartbeat to me. She's watching a beautiful pink still horizon. The geese have been up grazing since the shipping forecast. Actually, the geese are heading north.
Yeah, I heard geese this morning.
The geese are heading north. They're actually, because I mean, I've over the last 3 or 4 days, I've seen waves of them heading north, so they're on the way out.
Yeah.
Aileen said, is it the beat of a wee blackbird's heart after being caught and released by a peregrine? I think it might be going faster than that, Aileen. She's looking forward to working in a garden.
Alistair and Elgin, I love Alistair's messages. At last, an easy mystery sound. It's a stiff southeasterly oscillating a loose sheet of rusty red wrinkly tin.
Well done,
of
Alistair.
Of course it is. Cloudy, dry and cold here, eagerly anticipating another cracking programme.
And just round the corner, Denise and Phil and Cloudy Rothes says, is today's mystery sound a bat echo locating its way around? We'll be off on our regular walk to the River Spey later, but this time with our new rescue dog, Dizzy the Staffy Cross. Great programme as always.
Lovely. Alan Mark says, perhaps the sound is the wing beat of a mute swan. Difficult to hear, right enough. If incorrect, I'll get the headphones ready.
Get the headphones ready.
Get in touch if you want to have a guess. Email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or give us a ring 0808 592 9500. Now, we're sticking with whales. If you're interested in whales and what dolphins sound like, you might want to explore a new exhibition in Murray. The Scottish Dolphin Centre at Spey Bay has put together a new feature. It's really a new exhibition space, allowing visitors to hear and see various popular cetaceans. Manager Alison Rose invited me along to find out a bit more and actually to play a game of mystery sound.
It is one of the deepest frequency sounds you get in the animal kingdom. And it doesn't sound like anything. It's almost alien-like. It's so deep and you can hear it almost in your chest. And blue whales communicate with each other over vast, vast distances. They travel thousands of miles. They cover really far under the sea, and they want to keep in touch with each other. And the only way to communicate over hundreds of miles is to use very, very low frequencies. So that's what we're hearing. They're communicating over that distance.
On one of your information boards here, it says that some of these creatures have different accents and dialects. How are you able to tell that?
So different researchers all over the world have been recording underwater sounds for decades now, and you know, analysis of all that data has shown that different groups of whales around the world indeed have different cultures, different dialects, and in that way they're very like people. You know, we sound different when we're from different parts of the UK, and the same thing has happened in the animal kingdom, in the whales, and they teach their young how to communicate, and obviously they've picked up that accent, that dialect, from their parents effectively. So it's absolutely fascinating, but there's still and huge amount of things we don't know. We don't really know what they're saying to each other most of the time. We know that they're communicating about things like prey, where the prey is, about danger to their young ones, and different species also have their own signature whistles, which are almost like a name. So they have individual whistles when they're referring to individual dolphins. And what the research has shown is when a new baby dolphin is born, the mother makes up a name for that baby and keeps repeating it, so the baby learns their name. And that is a fact that we tell our visiting families a lot, and children are so fascinated by that, because effectively, the parents name their children just like in humans. You know, it's really fascinating.
So from a very deep sound to quite a squeaky one, let's hear the orca. So very different.
Very different. And orca you can see here in Scotland. You know, they live in Scottish waters. They are so iconic, that beautiful black and white body. Now, orca, we're talking about different dialects around the world. Different orca groups around the world hunt very differently. Now, the orca that are hunting for marine mammals, so the ones that eat, for example, seals, hunt silently because they don't want their prey to hear them. Different groups of orca who eat fish don't mind if the fish hear them, because the fish don't realise what's happening, and they're the ones that are producing these whistles and different noises. Orca are very communicative, their group dynamics are very, very strong, and that's what we can hear when they are talking to each other and communicating with each other, these whistling sounds.
Another sound then is the humpback whale. I think that's a bit like a creaking door.
Mm-hmm, definitely like a creaking door. And humpback males sing, and they sing these beautiful, complex songs. And we don't know for sure, but we think they're serenading the females. So we think they're you know, putting on their best voice and trying to attract the girls. And the longest recorded song for humpback whales is nearly 24 hours. This guy didn't stop singing for. So they are fascinating, and they are the original whale song. You know, that kind of putting you to sleep, the CDs that used to come out, they are the humpback whale songs. They're beautiful, you know, and they are a migratory species. They also travel long, long distances in the sea. So again, they would use quite big, loud voices to communicate with each other across that ocean.
I wonder if the object of his affections got a bit sick of that.
You would think, after 24 hours.
You are in such a beautiful location here at Spey Bay, and you now have live cameras that people can control so that they can zoom in on anything they can see outside.
Yeah, we love this. So it means on a day like today, which is quite grey and wet, you don't have to brave the outdoors if you don't want to. You can come in here and see what's going on. It's also great for accessibility. So if you can't walk very far, you can't get out on the shingle beach, you can come and still see what's going on from the comfort of our exhibition. We also get people trying to find their friends and family outside and doing little dances for the camera, so people have great fun with them. But it also means we can spot, you know, the dolphins, the seals, all the other wildlife that's going on right outside the building.
One thing that you get a great view of just now from your cameras is the shingle, and you've certainly felt the impact of the recent storms.
Definitely. We've been seeing the shingle beach move over the big storms this winter. The Spey Bay estuary has changed shape dramatically, you know, as it always does. But there's been so many big storms this season, and we've been on flood warning plenty of times as well. So, you know, the landscape is changing. The weather has been wild. And Spey Bay is a very, very dynamic place. It changes. So our visitors who haven't been for a while can't believe how much the river mouth has changed in shape.
Alison Rose there from the Scottish Dolphin Centre at Spey Bay. Now, we're going to stick with the sounds of the sea. After a discovery was made recently about how some of the largest whales in the ocean produce their songs. To explain that, we're joined by Dr. Denise Riche, who's a marine mammal ecologist with the Scottish Association for Marine Science, the aforementioned SAMS. Thanks for joining us, Denise. This study was about baleen whales. What is baleen?
Good morning. Nice to be here. So baleen refers to the way they don't have teeth. So it's baleen whales are all the large whales, like minke whales that we find in Scottish waters, but also the blue and fin whales belong to them. And the baleen is they're using to filter their food out of the water. That's where the name is coming from.
So tell us about your new discovery then.
So the discovery is not a study that I was involved in, but it's a groundbreaking discovery that was made by colleagues from Denmark about how baleen whales are producing their sounds. They are obviously really big animals. The blue whale is over 30 meters, so you can't put them in a lab and study them. So this study found a very interesting way to do this. They basically took the larynxes or the voice boxes of whales that were freshly stranded, and they blew air through them and used some computer modeling to show and improve how these whales might be producing these sounds, which previously we did not know, even though we do know their sounds because they have been recorded for many decades now.
That's an extraordinary idea. So basically they took compressed air and shoved it in one end of the voice box and a noise came out of the other.
Exactly, and the noise that they were able to produce matched the ones that we are recording with our hydrophones. So that is a lot of our work here at SAMS. We put underwater microphones in out in the ocean, and we are recording these beautiful songs of humpback whales, for example, as they travel by our coasts here in Scotland in the spring. We can record those, but even though we could describe these sounds, we didn't really know. How the whales are actually producing them, and now we have a bit of an insight to that. And we also learned from the study that we had seen in our recordings, that some of these whales are producing distinct sounds at the same time, so they can produce two sounds at the same time, and which is called biphonation. And that's discovery of how they produce sounds. We now know that they basically have two sound production mechanisms, so that's very exciting.
So what's the second sound production mechanism if it's not the voice box?
So it is also the voice box, but they basically have two ways of vibrating the folds that are within it. So whereas before we thought they would have only one mechanism, we now know it's two.
So what does this mean in terms of, you know, other sounds that might be in the ocean just now, you know, from shipping, etc.?
So what the research also shows, and that's very important, is that the way they produce sounds actually constrains how high up they can go in their sounds. So they are typically producing sounds in the low frequencies, below a few hundred hertz, and that's where a lot of shipping noise and other human-made noise in the oceans also sits, which means that they are actually quite restricted in how they can how far they can vocalize. And the louder we are in the ocean, the less room whales have to communicate. And we've known this for a while. This research now shows that they really have no way to go higher up in their frequency very much. And they also can only produce sound up to about a depth of 100 meters, which was also not known before. So they really have less room to escape the noise that we are producing. And that's very important if you think about conservation. These whales are using these sounds to find each other, to find their mates. As we just heard, the humpback whales are singing. They need sounds to find food and also to navigate. So the more we restrict the range over which they can communicate, the less space they have to go about their lives. So reducing underwater noise is really important in terms of their conservation.
I find this absolutely fascinating, because you were talking about basically putting compressed air through voice boxes, etc., and creating these sounds. And I was thinking, of course, then, you know, that's not an entirely accurate representation, because naturally this happens underwater. But it doesn't. These are, basically, they hold their breath. These are mammals. They take a breath at the surface, they dive down. So essentially, water is not passing through the voice box at the same time. I find this incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible. So basically, they're using a very similar mechanism to how we produce sounds, and they're recycling the air through the lungs, that's how they can produce sounds for quite some time. So it's really fascinating how they do that.
Denise, that's been really, really interesting. Thank you very much for your time this morning. Much obliged to you.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Dr. Denise Riche there from SAMHS. Across on the west coast. Now, one of the most prominent sites across on the west coast in Oban is McCaig's Tower. It looks a wee bit like the Coliseum. It overlooks Oban Bay, and it's named after a guy called John McCaig, who commissioned the tower in the late 1800s. Now, recently, because I was across there, I took a trip up to the tower with Bob McCulloch of the Lorne Archaeological and Historical Society.
We're walking into the circlet that crowns the hill above Oban. It's known as McCaig's Tower.
There is a pink granite plaque just in the entrance gate, erected in 1900 by John Stuart McCaig, art critic. I can't read the rest of that. What does it say?
Philosophical essayist and banker.
I wasn't going to guess philosophical essayist, not from this distance.
Well, it's quite funny that he puts banker last, but banker's the one that financed everything else that went before.
Why did he want to build this?
Vanity.
Expand on that.
Well, he had travelled a bit. He had amassed a fortune for any time. And folks always used to say he was trying to imitate the Colosseum.
Which, I have to say, from a distance, it's kind of got that feel about it.
It's tiny compared to the Colosseum. But it's fitted to the structure. It covers the hill nicely. It's an eye-catcher. It's given Oban a bit of a brand. But I think when you boil it all down, he wanted to commemorate himself and his family. They had no children, 9 siblings, no children. But one of the funny things about the family is we don't know that much about them. They didn't feature much in writings. Nobody, as far as I can tell, has ever done a life of the McCaig or the McCaig family. And for a family of cotters who came from a wee farm in Lismore, you might well say, how did they come to be so rich that at the end of their lives they're living in great big, effectively mansions, and leaving millions of pounds? And what did they do in between to make that money?
Who built this? Who physically built it?
The stonemasons who were in Oban at the time, a lot of them were probably local, but quite a few possibly came from away. Oban in the last quarter of the 19th century had experienced a huge building boom. Uh-huh. Now, most of the properties were built in those days with stone, but that was not always ongoing. There were times of layoffs and unemployment. And to his credit, McCaig specified that the men should be employed when there was nothing else that they could do.
So effectively this was an employment scheme, seasonal employment scheme?
It was. But other folks with a more cynical eye have said he got them when the work was cheap.
When they were cheap. We've just stepped out from inside the circle to outside the circle. What a fantastic view.
Interestingly enough, this modern viewing platform that we're on cost about £5,000. Around about 2000-ish, when the original tower, the whole thing was built, the whole thing cost about £5,000.
And as we see it today, is this what he envisaged? Is this what he wanted to build?
No. No, he died before the project was finished. He hoped to build a tower inside, which would go another 100 feet up. Yeah. He was also keen on commemorating the family in a more physical way by commissioning statues. These statues were to stand in the niches of the lower floor. Uh-huh. Each statue was to cost not less than £1,000 at that time. And then later, his will was partly set aside, and the family didn't want to carry on with spending that sort of money. But the next in line was Catherine, his sister, and she also wanted to commemorate, and I think there was something like 5 statues she was specifying, and she wanted them to be put on the very top.
Okay, on the wall.
On the wall. There was humour in the court when it was taken and read out.
So it was contested?
It was contested, and it was seen as a vanity project and, frankly, a waste of money. And there was a concern that all over Scotland, rich people would be popping up these follies, as they were sometimes called. The will was changed, and, in fact, the money turned into a bequest, which has been of great benefit to the town and to, in particular, Gaelic scholars. Down the 100 or so years.
I meant to ask you about that because, you know, as you come to the bottom there in the car park, it says McCaig's Tower.
Yeah.
Lots of people call it a folly. What, I mean, you're local. What do you call it?
I've always called it a tower. Folly or a tower, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. As you rightly pointed out on the way in, you know, it is such an imposing structure. Whether it's got a point or not, it very much gives Oban an identity.
It does, and when you turn the corner and you're seeing Oban from the sea when you're coming in, it's an immediate landmark. We're pleased with it, we're quite proud of it, but had it gone as he intended with the statues, it was going to be railed off, the public would not have had access to it. I've had access to it all my life. I think you definitely would have seen it as a megalomaniac Victorian moneymaker.
It looks as if there's more rain coming in, so let's go back inside the circle. It's actually built on something called Battery Hill. Presumably yes. There was a gun emplacement here at some stage.
There was. It was just a line of old Victorian cannons. Some of them were not even mounted. They just lay on the ground, and if somebody important came into town, they might loose off a few blank shots by way of a greeting.
It's a fabulous structure.
It did what he wanted. It perpetuated the name, and it gave a bit of extra work to a few of the local men. So, job done.
Bob McCulloch there of the Lorne Archaeological and Historical Society.
Yeah, it's probably nicer without the statues.
If you had a statue made of yourself, what pose would it be in?
I don't know, something quite commanding, I think. I think I would have it made where I looked about 6'2". I've always wanted to be taller. This would be my opportunity. What about you?
I honestly don't know. I don't know. Like Rodin's thinker, but portlier. Probably.
I'd probably just look like a gipe, you know, let's be honest.
Oh, the word gipe is a wonderful word. Northeast word, actually meaning an idiot or a twit or something like that. We've got lots of daffodils outside the front at the moment. Only one is out, and it's called gipe. Gipe the daff.
So it doesn't know it shouldn't be out quite yet. Although in some parts of Scotland they are out.
Yes, down south there's lots and lots of daffodils out. But in Aberdeenshire, not so much.
No, not so much. I was in North Berwick this week and on my drive down I could definitely see some daffs.
Indeed. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stevens. Sitting right next to me at the fire here in Beechgrove is Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, look the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is also available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to this. Get in touch, which is what Sarah Mace did. Says, hi there. Just wanted to say I really enjoy listening to your podcast from here in New Zealand. It's so informative with interesting interviews and also the jokes are entertaining.
I think you inserted that bit. She says, I've been doing a bit of driving lately, so the 1.5 hour versions are great for longer trips. We're moving into autumn here now, so enjoy your spring. Cheers, says Sarah.
Let us go back now, and I should warn you, if you're having your breakfast at the moment, maybe, gloss over this, I don't know, have a coughing fit. Back to the conservation breeding programme for medicinal leeches at the Highland Wildlife Park now.
Yeah, the experts from the RZSS harvested 12 leeches from a loch near Oban last year, and they hope they'll manage to successfully breed them over the next few months. As Dr. Helen Taylor explains, there's a lot of hoping for the best when you're dealing with these kinds of creatures because there's still relatively little known about them.
It's going to be really interesting because this is a first for us. So like a lot of the species we work with, we're kind of figuring it out as we go along. We've been able to find some stuff in the literature from people who've studied them way back when. And obviously with people breeding them commercially, the other species for medicine, there's some information around. What we're going to do is wait for the water temperature to come up a little bit, get them a little bit more active, get them really well fed, and then start putting them together in groups and see what they do, basically. What's really cool about leeches is that they are hermaphrodites, so they have both sets of genitals in their faces. That's where their genitals live, because of course they do, because this animal is nuts. And so that means that we don't need to worry about pairing a male with a female or anything like that. We can just put them together and let them get on with it. And we've seen a little bit of mating behaviour when we first brought them in. And it's kind of like they twist each other around into kind of a pretzel shape, and then they can just swap gametes. Yes. So they can swap their eggs and sperm between each other and cross-fertilise and exchange all the different genetic material they need to do to breed. And then we wait a little while. And then what happens is they build a cocoon out of their own slime. So just when you thought they've got, like, super disgusting, it gets worse. So what they do is they sort of exude this slime out of their body and then they shimmy backwards out of it, they reverse out of it and leave this little cocoon case stuck on the side of, like, some moss or, in our case, maybe on the side of a tank. And then they lay their eggs into this cocoon, which is going to protect their babies and keep them really safe, and then leave the eggs there to hatch and come out. And then hopefully we get lots and lots of tiny baby leeches.
And do you know when that might happen?
We're not 100% sure. It is going to be a very much a sort of suck it and see. So what we'll do, we keep the tanks here at ambient temperature, roughly what should be happening over in Oban. So we can keep an eye on the weather there and see what's happening there. So we'll bring the temperature up if needs be here. And then as soon as we see them getting active, we'll put them together. We would anticipate it would be kind of around April, May time. That's when we think it's happening in the wild. But again, there's just so little data on this. And that's the really cool thing about having them here in a conservation breeding program is that we can actually learn a lot about them and what they need and what kind of temperature they want and what kind of time of year all this stuff is happening just from having them here. So that then it helps us, but it helps understand what they need in the wild as well for conservation purposes.
And assuming that that's successful, you will then release them back into the wild.
Yes, that's the idea, is that we want more leeches and more medicinal leeches in more places. So we're going to breed as many as we can here and then aim to get them out into new sites in Scotland so that we haven't got just these three sites where it's like if something happens to them, then it's really bad news for medicinal leeches. The more places we can put them, the better state that population will be in. So we're in very early stages at the moment, but that is the long-term goal for the project.
They haven't really got a cute face, have they? You know, when you talk about these breeding and release programmes, you know, you often think about wildcats, and wildcats are very cute. I think you would struggle to describe one of these medicinal leeches as cute.
Well, I personally think they're cute, but I'm probably one of the odd ones out in that regard. It's quite interesting watching them, especially when we've had like groups and such in here. You start seeing little faces poking out from under the rocks, just like, ooh, what's going on? So yes, they're not quite as charismatic as some of the larger, fluffier species we've got, but they're definitely cute in their own unusual way.
But it is important that we care, isn't it, Helen?
Absolutely. So I would contend cool rather than cute. So, you know, think of an animal that can survive purely on blood. We watch them feeding. In the space of 15 minutes, we've got an animal that can go from weighing 7 grams to weighing almost 40 grams. They inflate like a balloon. The pressure internally that they're putting on their bodies when they take in that much fluid in a short space of time, if we tried to do that, we would explode.
This individual actually went from around 7 grams up to 38, so like 5 times its own body weight. They feed quite reasonably quickly in comparison, like how quickly they can get that amount in, but just seeing them expand to that level is utterly insane.
It's one of those things where you can't look away. So it's one of those things where you come in and you're like, this is going to really gross me out, but then you start watching it and you can't stop because it's so incredible and you can see them growing in real time, and you're just like, this is mad. So I definitely think they're at the cool end of the spectrum on animals. And in terms of looking after them and conserving them, A, because they're cool, obviously, but also because they have an intrinsic value in the ecosystems that they're living in. So, you know, we focus a lot, or people tend to focus a lot, on big charismatic animals like wildcats, like beavers. RZSS works on those species, and it's absolutely right that we do so. They're very important. But if we're not looking after stuff at the other end of the spectrum as well, you're not going to have healthy functioning ecosystems to release these larger animals back into. Animals like leeches, pine hoverflies, dark border beauty moths, the other invertebrate species that RZSS works on, are all playing really key roles in their ecosystem, whether that's a functional role like pine hoverfly as a pollinator or as a food source, part of a food web, carrying a parasite ecosystem in their own body. You know, all of these animals are playing a really important role. And when you start to lose them from ecosystems, the ecosystems start to fall apart. And at that point, you lose your spaces for all the other species that you're trying to save as well.
So they are in a fragile state in the wild. How quickly could you turn this situation around, do you think?
Any kind of conservation, species conservation project is a long-term effort. So whenever we get involved with a project, we're in it for the long run. This isn't just like 2 years and we're out. It's going to take longer than that to restore the fortunes of a species. We don't know exactly how many babies each leech is going to be able to produce. So at the moment, we have 12 leeches in the breeding program here. We may get some more next year. Let's say each leech was able to produce 20 individuals. They'll probably be able to produce more than that, but let's say 20 to be conservative. We're then in a position where we can start to do some releases, and we'd start that in a very trial way. So like pick one site, release some individuals, monitor those individuals, how are they doing? And then we can keep breeding them here and keep building the numbers and then just build and build and build. But it's very much a long-term effort for sure.
That's Dr. Helen Taylor and Adam Button from the RZSS. I think it is really interesting that they still use leeches in medicine. I mean, not these meat leeches, obviously.
No.
They are protected. You can't harvest them at all now. But they have got, I think they're Mediterranean leeches that they breed in a facility in Wales, I think.
I think so.
Still used in hospitals. Can you imagine being the patient and being told, oh, we're just going to use leeches here?
It's to encourage blood flow to a particular site.
Yeah, it is,
know,
yeah.
So I think it's used in things like plastic surgery.
It is, and grafting and,
skin grafts
and that
sometimes.
Kind of thing, yeah. So very clever.
Yeah.
It does give me the heebie-jeebies a little bit.
Well, I'm not going to make it any better, because the other thing, to get rid of necrotic tissue, they still use maggots occasionally.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they're very, very good at cleaning up a wound.
Yeah.
So again, if you're having your breakfast, we're really,
really
sorry
really
this morning.
Sorry.
We're contractually obliged to talk about these
to
things.
To gross you out.
Yeah,
precisely. It's a bit like those tanks you can put your feet in and the little fish eat the dead skin.
Would you do that?
No, absolutely not. I wouldn't inflict my feet on anything.
Why are the fish jumping out of the water?
Again, apologies if you're eating your
breakfast. Yeah, exactly. Right, let's change the subject completely, for the love of goodness. If you are a transport fan, and who isn't, all roads lead to Afford in Aberdeenshire.
Your favourite thing, isn't
it?
Oh,
tell you. Not only is it the town home to the Grampian Transport Museum, which is superb, by the way, but you can also find there the Afford Valley Community Railway, which is equally brilliant if you're a man of a certain age. Actually, any age, it doesn't matter. At the moment, the volunteers of the railway are working on a really interesting project, as Tony Scott explains here.
I just love the smell of oil. Nothing smells like that. Yeah, so down at the bottom here is the tram that I've been working on about a year. I've been on this little job.
This is a former Aberdeen tram?
This is a former Aberdeen tram.
How did it survive?
We have no idea how it survived, because I'm sure people know that they were all burnt. Yeah. But this
one an extraordinary act of vandalism, yes, when they decided to close the tram line. They took everything down to the beach and they basically gave them a Viking funeral. They burned all the trams.
Right, right. That's quite right. Yeah, over 2 days. 2 days it took them to burn all the trams. But this one survived. We believe it's tram number 11. It's had extensive reworking done on it. Right. And as you can see, it's now undergoing quite a lot of repair, remedial work. And hopefully we'll get it back on this track in the next year.
Is it safe to go up into it?
It's quite safe if we go around the other side.
Okay. Now you've kind of got steps here. Here we go. Look, after you.
Now we can go this way.
Yep. So. Well,
this would have been... This is all the original woodwork in here. This is just fantastic. You've got a walnut ceiling. All this... This is all papier-mâché up here, which is then gilded.
This is an extraordinary survival. And it is really surprisingly decorative, too.
Yes, yeah.
And has that been painted to look like sort of verdigris copper?
I believe so, yes.
The quality of coachmanship in this, though, is just extraordinary. I mean, the woodwork's superb.
Yeah. This is all oak. All the framework here is oak. Papier-mâché, and then this lovely, what I think is walnut ceiling.
But look how they've decorated down here. You know, they've got little finials carved into the wood. I mean, for no good reason other than the fact that it looks bonny.
It looks nice, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Pure and simple.
Yeah.
And would these have been the original seats? Because they're not leather.
I think these will have been recovered at some point.
Aye.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking 100 years, so...
It's Corporation Green.
Corporation Green, yeah. Yeah.
Possibly not the original flooring either, too. And with this, I suppose the driver could have stood at either end.
At either end, the driver would have stood, yeah. There would originally have been stairs going up from either end onto a top deck. Uh-huh. And the top deck would have been almost the same as this upstairs. Not open, so that you're quite safe from not touching the wires. The overhead wires, it would have come off overhead wires.
Aye. And where did this tram originally run?
It would have run at Bealside.
So, centre of Aberdeen, out to Bealside and back again.
Yeah, I'll show you a photograph of it. This is tram number 11. This is the tram we believe is this tram. As you can see, it's the three large windows and six hoppers. And you can see the pickup wire. If I zoom in, you'll be able to see the pickup wire. Uh-huh. The pickup there and the wire across the top. So it would have been an electrified tram.
Because I can remember, I've been in a museum, it's down near Lanark, I think it was, but they actually have a long insulated pole that they flip the wires across, you know, so you can then change direction and head back in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Just look at this, though. That door operates, no bother at all, it's over 100 years old. Where did you get this from?
This was here when the community railway took over. This was sitting here and had been used. Uh-huh. But we believe it was somebody's garden shed.
Dirty lucky devil.
Yes, yeah.
This would be a fantastic garden shed because, I mean, you literally, the windows all round.
Yeah.
I mean, the light to work in here would be superb. Yeah.
I would have thought it would have made a great greenhouse.
Even better.
Yeah.
Even better.
Yeah.
What a machine. And so, such a rare survival.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Unique, I think.
Yeah.
And it's an absolute pleasure to work on it.
Yeah.
Absolute pleasure.
So what still needs to be done to it?
Oh, gosh.
A list as long as your arm.
I've currently got the hoppers here are all in my workshop. The bits of that actually drop down to let air in.
Okay.
There's a hopper goes into there. They've got stained glass in them. So that's actually...
Oh, beautiful.
So that's actually one piece out of all of the hoppers. One piece was broken. Aye. So we're actually getting that made. Oh, the glass is actually getting made by a company in England and getting shipped up to us so we can actually replace that one piece of glass.
Maybe get two bits made.
I think we should, yeah. Yeah. There is a couple of patches on the outside have been done. You can see that the whole of that side, far side, has been, the offside has had to be replaced. Mm-hmm. We thought, when I first started, I would be done by Christmas. Thankfully, I didn't tell them which Christmas.
No.
I'm looking at about 46 day's work to get this pulled round, which is, what, 9 weeks if I was here full-time, but I'm not. I've got other things to do, so I'm only here. And it's all done by volunteers. Mm-hmm. So we're always looking for people to come along and give us a hand.
What about the rolling gear underneath?
The rolling gear, the bogies are getting repaired. There's actually a farmer has taken them off to do some repairs on them. We lost one of the pins, needs replacing. You can't just unscrew stuff.
No.
You've really got to work at it. And over the years, this is, as I said before, this is oak. And people have just used, you know, steel screws and things like that to repair it. And the problem is there's a chemical reaction between oak and steel, which actually bonds the steel basically to the oak. So
I didn't know that.
When you try to take a screw out of oak, you if it's a steel screw, you just give up. And you've got to actually then drill it out.
Will this ever run again?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
But you're not going to commit to which Christmas?
I'm not going to commit to which Christmas, but it'll be ready for Christmas in the future.
Tony Scott of the Afford Community Railway. And later this morning, the railway are holding a volunteer open day. So if you'd like to help out in any way, shape or form or be part of the maintenance and ground crew, just get along there. You'll find a link to the railway on our website.
Yeah. Sounds great, actually. Why did they burn them all? What a weird thing to do.
If you stand in that thing in Afford and you see the quality of coach building and craftsmanship and just, I mean, it is beautiful because they wanted it to be beautiful. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, nowadays people build stuff and it's utilitarian and it's fine and
functional.
it does the job. But back then they took a pride in public transport. And, you know, when you see the quality of that and you think, how did anybody think burning all these things was a good idea?
Yeah, a terrible waste. There must have been people at the time saying, hold on a minute here, this is ridiculous.
Beats me. Beats me, but I mean, seriously, you need to have one of those things in your back garden as either a shed or a workshop. Man, I would have had dozens of them if I'd had the chance.
Yeah, I bet you would.
A bit before my time, truth be told. But anyway, we've got a mystery sound which is causing slight confusion this morning. We are getting correct answers in, but these are some of the wrong ones.
Yeah, Marion and Kinross, good morning, lovely people. A brilliant show as ever. A must-listen start to every Saturday morning. Is the mystery sound a leech sucking blood? No, because that would be a yelping sound, Marion.
James of Helensburgh said, busy week in the Helensburgh Submarine Centre, which is hosting the Warhead exhibition on behalf of the Erskine Hospital to highlight the way that arts workshops help service veterans to overcome mental illness. Is the mystery sound a bullfrog, he says.
Tony Jambo in Edinburgh says, is it
not
Hibs?
His real name?
No, I think not. Is it Hibs supporters banging their heads on the wall after another Derby defeat?
Yeah, there's actually a theme here. Graham in Rosemount says, it sounds like the rise in excitement of the heartbeat of an Aberdeen fan in expectation, followed by a fall in realisation. Or maybe a hibernating hedgehog heartbeat. That's a good idea, actually.
It is, yeah. Jill Sutherland in Rattray says, is it a dolphin calling recorded by a hydrophone?
And Catherine Falkirk says, it's a butterfly settling on a flower.
All will be revealed very, very soon.
Yeah, now, we would like to introduce you to some of the more unusual outdoor activities on this programme, and we do, but Pegasus Vaulting Group, based near Killiecrankie, is right up there because it involves highly skilled gymnasts performing on horseback.
Look, it's right up my street. We heard about
this. You were
good at this. Very good. We heard about this through the Enchanted Forest Community Fund, who've donated money to help them buy a new vaulting simulator. So I went along to a training session with gymnast Madison Davis and boss Kirsty McWilliam.
So our racewood simulator has started and Madison's touching the handles and she jumps 1, 2, 3 up and onto the horse. She comes upside down and then goes straight into a shoulder stand. A lovely roll down there and she spins into a press up on the horse's bum. Then she steps back and straight into her dismount for her finale piece.
Wow, that's really, really impressive. So what we're talking about here is effectively gymnastics on horseback, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. It's gymnastics on horseback, almost yoga poses on horseback, but with a little bit of dance and choreography in there as well, where we link all the movements together. And the sport is really changing to look at the dance and choreography aspect as a much higher percentage of your mark, and also the harmony and softness with the horse. So this is why a vaulting simulator like this is so good for us because it saves the horse going round and round for practice, which it means the vaulter can practice again and again to make the moves absolutely perfect before we put them on the horse.
It must be hard to do just when you're on a flat, even surface, but when you're doing it on something that's moving, it must be so challenging.
Yes, it is. It really is. So for some of the younger vaulters, it's learning to absorb the movement while still having a form and a shape. And that is the hard bit because you have to have the tension with the softness. So whereas the gymnastic floor is solid and you're always pushing off a solid surface or like a springy but powerful surface, whereas this you have to absorb all the movement the whole time. So for girls like Madison who are training, who are hopefully going for GB junior selection this year, they're training most days. So 3 to 4 days with us, with the horses and with the simulator, but then they're training at home with their own practice barrels, which are oil drums on legs, and then doing lots of fitness, gym work, strength work, flexibility work as well.
So they need to be gymnasts and, I suppose, horse riders as well to be able to do this.
Well, it's quite interesting because we don't always have vaulters that come from a horse riding background. So the gymnastic and the fitness element is more important, but the relaxation with the horse and enjoying the sport with the animal and that harmony and connection with your animal, I think, is really important. So a little bit of both, but actually the gymnastics helps more because they're more physically fit.
Now, you set this club up. How did it come about?
So it was me and my mother set this club up. I used to compete for Scotland and Great Britain when I was a teenager. And then when I left school, we looked at setting up this club so that we could have our vaulting horses and then produce on kids. So slowly it started with only 2 members, and now it's grown to now we have 24.
Yeah, so there's obviously quite a lot of appetite for this.
Yeah, and I think getting into horses in the horse world is quite difficult because there's not that many places around as much. But vaulting was really originated from having a group of people sharing the cost for one horse. So it makes it more accessible for people rather than having their own horse and having all of the costs associated with that horse. So it means that more people can enjoy equestrianism as a sport, but it's not so expensive compared to some of the other equestrian hobbies.
And were you a horse rider first or a gymnast?
A little bit of both. I was a bad horse rider. I was very gung-ho and very, they used to call me Kamikaze Kirsty, so I would try anything. And my gymnastic talent, I think I was brave. I maybe didn't have massive, massive skill, but I had real effort and hard work. So you can get there with anything if you've got that.
Let's have a quick word with Madison. Madison, I think I'm going to have to stand on my tiptoes to reach you up here on top of the simulator. How did you get into it?
So I just used to live up the hill, and my mum at the time didn't drive, but we just moved here and we heard about it from friends, and so it was quite easy for me to get down. And then I had a day of trying it and then just absolutely loved it. I was a bit crazy, I'd hang off of walls and it was just totally up my street, so I was a bit gung-ho as well, and then just kept coming and yeah.
And obviously you enjoy being on horses. You must do
yeah.
this.
Yeah, no, totally. There's just something about kind of the connection between you and your horse going out and like being able to show people what you can do and all the hard work. It's quite good.
Can we meet some of your horses?
Yep, I'm sure we can, yeah. So this is Pilgrim. He is one of our horses that are main competition horses. So he does our advanced team and he also does our little ones team and sometimes a few individual vaulters as well. So he's just chilling out, eating some haylage at the bale right now, and he's also got his massage rug on. So he's been exercised this morning already just to make sure that he's really fit and strong, and now he's having his massage before he goes out in the field for the day to roll around in the mud.
So does that mean that not any horse can do this? Are you looking at ones with particular attributes?
So every horse could do this to a level generally that is quite a quiet horse. So you're really looking for the temperament, that the horse is quite trainable, is interested in work and likes to do different things, but also has to have that affinity with people. So it's a tractor going past. You can see it's always a farm day here. So yeah, so that's what you're looking for foremost. And then in the higher level competition horses, you're looking for a really good quality canter. And the lower levels, you're looking for a sort of smaller, chunkier kind of cobby type horse, just so that it's really safe for beginners.
And the gymnasts must build up pretty special relationships with these horses.
Yeah, I think they do. I think that it's a three-way sport. So you have the horse, you have the vaulter, and you also have the lunger. So the lunger is the one in control of the horse. So the horse goes round on basically a rope that's on a 15-metre circle, and the lunger is giving the aids to the horse the whole time. But it is a three-way partnership. So the vaulter has to be soft on the horse for the horse to be nice and relaxed, and the lunger has to aid that horse to be able to go the best way it can for the vaulter. So it's a really sort of three-way circle.
Do you think the horse can feel the pressure if you're, you know, taking part in a competition?
Some do and some don't. So Pilgrim gets a little bit more tense in new environments because he's very nosy and he likes to look at everything and he's like, ooh, look at this. And he kind of has quite a short attention span, whereas Billy is just a total old pro and he just doesn't, he goes into new environments and is like, all right, cool, where's my food? And he's just, he's not bothered. And that's the same with our other two horses, Zoro and Orion. They're pretty chilled.
Madison, have you got a favourite?
Yeah, I think Billy has to be my favourite. At competitions, he's just a total dude, and if I'm feeling a bit nervous, he doesn't pick up on that and is always there to reassure me. He's a good boy.
Oh, lovely. The group competes in competitions all over the world. Have a wee look at their Facebook page if you want to see them in action. The Enchanted Forest Community Fund donates money raised from the Light and Sound Show, The Enchanted Forest, to various local groups and charities, and many of them are connected to the outdoors. If you're interested in that, applications for this year's funding are being welcomed now, I think until about the end of the month, so have a look.
Such a shame that the bit where you actually did it was edited out.
It was, yeah. It's because I was so good I didn't want to put Madison to shame.
I should
point out to the listeners, actually, that you were showing off your gymnastic talents a little earlier. And Mark did a headstand, actual headstand, whilst we were listening to one of our features.
Nearly kicked the fire over in the process.
But it was very, very impressive. I have to say, I'm seeing you in a whole new light.
Yeah, well, upside down.
upside down, yeah.
It's a distinct improvement.
I did say it would be good if you could finish the programme upside down.
But I wouldn't rule it out yet. I fear for the bacon, but aside from that. Time now to reveal our mystery sound for this week. Let's have a final listen.
Pages and pages and pages of right answers.
Pages of correct answers. Absolutely. Yep. Gordon and Maureen Nethybridge says, is it a whale? Yes, it is.
Minky whale.
Minky
it's
whale
a minky
specifically.
Whale.
Specifically. Yep.
Daryl and Lindsay, Davy G in Renfrew also getting it right. Heather from Linlithgow. I like Ron from Stirling's comment. He says, Stirling, far from the sea, obviously. It's a minky whale with a Doric accent. Perhaps it's tried to chat up an oil rig by mistake.
There's actually something about that. Hang on a second. Karen in Shetland says, orca can recognise individual ship sounds. The famous case of the lone orca that befriended a particular supply ship and could hear it leaving Aberdeen from the northern oil fields. Used to meet it halfway. The crew used to scrub its belly with brushes. It lived in the warmer water near the platforms with the larger fish near the waste disposal outlets. I've never heard of that before, Karen, but if you know it to be true, if you were one of the people that was on that supply ship or something, please get in contact with us because we'd like to talk to you.
Yeah, it sounds like a fabulous story. Gavin from Cooper, normally, who's showing off and is in Madeira today, also got it right, as did Ross and Tainalt, who's very clever and thinks, oh yeah, they're bound to have a feature featuring the mystery sound in the programme now. Janet in Perth also getting it right as well.
Dougie and Anya says it's whales deep frequency calling to each other. They're off to Edinburgh today to the museums and a picnic in the meadows near the Whalebone Walk. Great show as always. Mark and Bill's Den got it right. Wee Stan got it right. Alison Seaton in Edinburgh got it right.
And Wendy Wu with a lovely story about whale watching close to Mull and seeing some spectacular things. Yeah. Really lovely email.
I need to apologise to Skye because apparently it wasn't her fault. Davy G's been back in contact to say, sorry about the bee in Crumbly.
as in Jim Crumbly. I mean, Jim is knocking on a bit, fair enough, but no, seriously, he won't like it. Davey says it was his fault, or more accurately, autocorrect on his mobile. It is, of course, Jim Crumbly. Check out Jim's books. Have a lovely weekend.
Okay, you stand corrected.
Yeah. Don't forget our new Scotland Outdoors podcast. We're nearly out of time, by the way. Available today at noon. Our midweek podcast is...
It's about Mountaineering Scotland. Two women have been appointed for the first time as the head of that, the chair and the president. So we hear a bit from them.
Good, okay. We'll have a chat with them midweek if you fancy getting on to that. In the meantime, that's all we've got time for from all of the team here in Aberdeen. Thanks for listening.